Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 294 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the 12th instalment of our Location and the Writer series, Horatio Clare takes us to Hebden Bridge and its connections with the poets Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. Then Lucy Moore celebrates the London she travels through at human pace on her bicycle. And finally, Curtis Jobling recalls Great Sankey, where childhood phantoms became the grown-up imaginings of unsettling fantasy novels. First, here's Horatio Clare on Hebden Bridge.
A satellite's view of Hebden Bridge shows a cruckle of deep green valleys between the spread brown hands of the moors. From the tops on a summer evening, the higher land folds in hazy swathes, the spire of Heptonstall Church aligning with the obelisk at Studley Pike and the distant wind farms, the valley bottoms hidden, their woods a mulched tangle of crowns and trunks, thick-leaved, riddled with streams, veined with tracks and dry stone walls. Nothing ever quite dries here. This is a world kneaded between water and rock. The land slips, the becks run red with iron and peat, the stones settle and darken. Millstone grit, a hard limestone, shades from honey to black as it ages in the Pennine rain. This is the country that made Ted Hughes, who loved and hated it. The shut-in sodden dreariness of the whole valley, the hopeless old stone trap of it, he wrote in The Stubbing Wharf, a poem from his masterpiece, The Birthday Letters. He and Sylvia Plath drank Guinness in a pub on a winter night and tried to see new ways out of their fate. The thought of living in the Calder Valley has her in floods of tears. I felt the same way when we moved here from Italy. In the remains of Elmet and Moortown, Hughes seems to have caught it and nailed it like a corpse to a gibbet, dank and blasted. The Stubbing Wharf sums it up. This gloomy memorial of a valley, the fallen in grave of its history, a gorge of ruined mills and abandoned chapels, the fouled nest of the Industrial Revolution that has flown. And yet, however deeply felt, however closely observed, howsoever thickly writing might be drawn from a landscape, words can no more fix or define a piece of the world than they can a person. The land itself is unset, and no 2 days are quite alike, though it can take an effortful looking to distinguish them. I write this on the 10th day of summer downpours. The rain-runnelled woods of the buttress beyond my window climb up to Heptonstall, where Plath is buried. Hughes's inscription on her headstone seems part prayer, part assertion, part epitaph. Something for her and for all those he knew would come to read it. Even amidst the fierce flames, the golden lotus can be planted. Nearby, Lum Bank, Hughes's house turned writing centre, blazes quietly on. Many of the greatest writers of our time have taught and learned and read and written and listened there. No wonder it took me some time to add my ink to the magnificent cauldron of this little world. I began with a children's book, Aubrey and the Terrible Ute, which was written partly to assure myself and my family that this was somewhere we could live and grow, as we moved from the easy splendours of the Veneto where our son was born. In fact, his pleasure in the place, his instant adoption of the beck, the woods, and his world of friends, taught me much more about it than I could ever show him. 10,000 visitors a year pass our windows on their ways to the National Trust tea rooms at Gibson Mill. If the white-haired stalwarts of that institution are the most numerous on weekdays, at the weekends come the gay couples hand in hand, the Asian families from Halifax, the French and the Poles, the international students and the children whose names speak of far horizons. Mohammed, Ember, Luna, Piper, Bodhi, Asher, Kalu, Micah, Kudiatu. Theirs is the song of this land now. Hughes worked to wring light from the shadows here. Lum Bank and the Arvon organisation were among his proudest achievements. He would be delighted to find that many writers work in his home valleys today. Zafar Kunil's superb collection, Us, springs from the paths of Nutcliffe Woods. Benjamin Meyer's majestic The Gallows Pole grew from his obsessive walking through Crag Vale. My own The Light in the Dark looked at days and nights in Hardcastle Crags in close miniature. There are more kinds of rain here than we have words for, I realised. In order to combat a tendency to shrink inwards in the winter, I studied this small valley in its details. I came to see the Pennine weather as a tremendous life-giving, if ferocious, gift. From the tiny bent heads of the mosses to the roiling sunset clouds, I recorded whatever caught my eye and forced myself to look, to see. This green summer I am keeping up the habit. 2 nights ago the moon rose out of mist and geese came over, gabbling a skein of cries. Herons flew up the river, uttering one zank each, as if calling the hours on a pagan sundial older than our idea of time. Today is the day of the woodpeckers, a green in the lane, his scarlet cap dragon bright, and a greater spotted in the garden just now, lighting up the birch tree. This kind of attention paying is a writer's work, we know, the dissolving of self into being. A few days ago we hiked a long horseshoe up Hebden Beck, through Hardcastle Crags, up to Widdop and back along the valley's shoulder to Heptonstall. We walked through green dells of wild garlic and myrtles, across moorland where lapwing, curlew and oyster catchers wheeled and whistled, over farmland where swallows chittered on the wires and a black horse came to take grass from our hands. We stopped for cuckoo calls and goldfinch flits. We rested by a pure surfacing of the beck, where there are orange-tipped butterflies, mayflies and pond skaters. We studied the chrysalises of caddisflies under stones. An oak tree, a wood, a stream, a valley, an entire vista may be an ecosystem, I explained, and my little boy seemed to understand intuitively. The experience of connection, a rootedness which is not limited to her horizon, which stretches to wherever we have been and wherever we might imagine, is a child's experience of knowing such a place as this. For the incoming writer, the encounter may be very different, but the result an exact echo. Sylvia Plath walked up this valley one night, as she records in her poem Hardcastle Crags. All the night gave her, in return, for the paltry gift of her bulk and the beat of her heart, was the humped indifferent iron of its hills and its pastures bordered by black stone set on black stone, barns, guarded broods and litters. Behind shut doors, the dairy herds knelt in the meadow, mute as boulders. In this, and in its companion piece, Wuthering Heights, the observation is acute. The poems tremble like young leaves in a present they describe as an interfeeling, an exchange between the place and the passerby. The sky leans on me, the one upright among all horizontals. And she catches it exactly, that almost intangible what it is to be here, that evolving moment-to-moment eternity in the soul, which is an echo of the eon-to-eon evolution of a place. Her poems about the lane outside the window and the moor tops beyond could have been written today. As Hebden has shifted from an industrial graveyard to a birthing place of ideas, work and art, Hughes's landscape has retreated. You can see it preserved, framed in the endless black and white photographs which decorate the shops, hotels and pubs of the town. But Plath's is palpably still here. Drawing Hardcastle Crags to a close, she writes, "The whole landscape loomed absolute as the antique world was, once in its earliest sway of lymph and sap, unaltered by eyes." Walk the lane now and you will find the experience is the same, of the looming absolute of this antique world, a lair in deep slowed step with human time. Children sense it immediately, they squeal and run through the woods. And so the poet, the child, and the place are an ecosystem of echoes, partly described by language, wholly linked by feeling, all here, all now, all in time and the rain.
That was Horatio Clare. You can find out more about Horatio on the RLF website. Next, here's Lucy Moore on London by Bicycle.
2 mornings a week for the past 2 years, I've cycled to work through South London, daydreaming past ravishingly gentrified villas expensively tinted in colours like string and London stone and savage ground and sullen 1960s estates, which could do with a lick of paint. I jostle alongside my fellow commuters as we pass Brunswick House, built in 1758 and still standing in proud isolation on Vauxhall Roundabout. Once it overlooked the Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens, where young couples danced and flirted and contrived to lose their parents for 200 years between warts and all Oliver Cromwell and black bombazined Queen Victoria. Now it gazes out over a bus station and a pincushion of cranes. Although I don't go near Holland Park on this journey, it's a place I often think about at this spot. It was on one of my previous infrequent commutes through London, another of the silver smears left in my virtual wake. But I think about it here because, like the bristling cranes of this southern stretch of the Thames, it calls to mind the new city rising up all around me and the old one being born back into the past. An ancient aunt of my father's lived in a bedsit in shabby Holland Park in the 1950s. A spinster, living on very little, she inhabited a tiny corner of a once grand 19th century mansion. I picture a beloved cat. From its splendid origins as the showcase residence of a rich merchant and his family a century earlier, it had become the final resting place of the down on their luck. Today, of course, the house is surely gleaming again, buffed and polished by the energetic wife of an American banker. And where will it be tomorrow? And where will we all be? Then I cross the river, where the slight tang of salt in the air and the sight of the water, khaki beneath lowering clouds or glittering in sunlight, never fail to raise my spirits. The early bird tourists of Covent Garden threaten to throw themselves into my path. Then the grimy cream terraces of Bloomsbury rise before me, and I know that coffee is not far away. Every time I take this route, I'm reminded of the same things at the same points. The road with the same name as a friend, who I think of each time I pass. The father cycling in the opposite direction, corralling a small, beshorted schoolboy on his own bike and a small dog perched in his basket. Where I encounter them tells me whether I'm running early or late. The spot where I saw a fellow cyclist break his nose on the unhearing skull of an earphoned jogger who stepped in front of him and then ran off, oblivious to our cries and the gushing blood. The roof terrace of the Riverside offices where, long ago, I was thrown a marvellous launch party for a book, which gave my husband to be entirely the wrong idea about publishing. On my bike I feel free. Being at the mercy of the weather is worth every second of liberation from the Stygian underground. With half my attention focused on traffic lights and puddles, the rest of my mind can wander. I'm no idle flaneur, detached and amused observer of the city. Adept to the joys of watching, as Susan Sontag put it, but travelling in a manner at once mundane, purposeful and meditative. I picture the vapour trails of my movements around the city in which I was born and in which I've lived for most of my life, thin silver threads in some places, thick rivers of mercury in others, like the route I took to school as a child in my mother's yellow Renault 4, or the route I now take my children along to their school. Will something of me remain in these places, along these ways? Anne Fanshawe, one of my subjects, had lodgings off the Strand when her royalist husband, captured by Oliver Cromwell, was imprisoned in 1651. Every morning before dawn from late September to late November, she walked along the same route through the grey streets to stand outside his window at Whitehall and plot with him about how to get him released. Is she still there, or is she in Portugal Row, which I pass later, a triumphant move which meant that her husband, for so long on the wrong side of events, had at last had his loyalty rewarded with the office of ambassador to Portugal? The privations of civil war forced women of Anne's class, brought up to move around the city enclosed within the velvet security of carriages and sedan chairs, to get around on foot. Hiring a coach for an hour was infinite dear in 1645, 18 pence an hour. At a time when royalist property was being sequestered and redistributed, this was a sum she could ill afford. I wonder if she relished the freedom walking offered her, like a suffragette enraptured by her bicycle, or whether she could only see the hardship, the contrast with the way things used to be, and, for her, the way they were meant to be. The soul of Vaclav Nijinsky, another subject, I feel sure lingers on the site of St. Stephen's Poorhouse, Fulham, long ago buried beneath the steel and glass vastness of Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. Late one night, a dishevelled young man in evening dress, unconscious, was brought to St. Stephen's, which had beds for the homeless. He astonished his fellow guests the next morning with a series of grand jetés over each of the 20 beds on either side of the ward. Though he spoke no English, somehow he managed to get word to his lover and protector, Sergei Diaghilev, at the Savoy. He arrived at the head of a cortege of taxis, scooped up his renegade friend, and their party drove away with a trail of gold in their wake, sovereigns scattered behind them like confetti. Each of us leaves behind the layers of our experience on the locations we inhabit or move through, like the patina on an old piece of furniture. The legendary antiques dealer Christopher Gibbs used to say that the kind of objects he liked best were the ones most used, that still seemed to preserve something of the people who once owned them. Fabrics discoloured by wear, walking sticks which supported their owners in old age, not the china they displayed in cabinets, but the plates off which they ate every day, their painted birds and flowers faded, the edges chipped. An exhibition a few years ago at the Foundling Museum included a piece by a British artist whose name I failed to write down. It was the cross-section of a stick, used by the artist's father to stir paint every time he repainted a room in the artist's childhood home, revealing thin layers of colour like the rings of a tree, markers of change, markings of time passing, a metaphor for the layers of memory and meaning that accumulate everywhere we've lived and every place we travel through.
That was Lucy Moore. You can find out more about Lucy on the RLF website. Finally, here's Curtis Jobling on Great Sankey.
As villages go, Great Sankey seems unremarkable. Located a couple of miles west of Warrington, it could be any other northern suburban sprawl, surrounded by motorways, power plants and industrial estates. There's no chocolate box village green, or manor house, or boating lake, or award-winning gastropub that provides a beating boozy heart to the community. It does, however, have its ghosts. I should probably add these aren't ghosts in the conventional sense. Sankey isn't giving Borley Rectory a run for its money anytime soon. That said, growing up in this suburb in the 70s and 80s, it still managed to fire this writer's imagination. The ghosts I speak of are memories. Events, recollections that had a powerful impact on my young mind and would be destined to stay with me. I blame my dear old mother, of course. So long as there wasn't a tropical storm raging across Cheshire, and thankfully they were rare, Mum would send me outdoors to play, come rain or shine. That's how I discovered so many of these wonderful locations as a child. I explored my environment. I got to know my world. I have Mum to thank for turning me into an adventurer and a storyteller. The old abandoned groundkeeper's shed behind the church, a stone's throw from my house. It was converted into a den by my mates and I, unbeknownst to the vicar. We had to visit it in pairs, thanks to its situation in the heart of the graveyard. No self-respecting child would dare such a journey alone. I would cycle past the cemetery every Thursday night on my return home from Dungeons and Dragons Club, pedalling furiously down St Mary's Road for fear of zombie attack. Thankfully, this was in the days before the sprinting undead of Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later, so it was just the regular George A. Romero shamblers I had to worry about. At the top of my parents' street was the former residence of one of the Titanic's doomed officers, Sankey Brook, which babbled and burbled its way through the village, the hunting ground of the fabled giant black rat. Warrington General Hospital, which I visited on more than one luckless occasion, pained, bent or broken in one fashion or another. The local railway station on the Liverpool to Manchester line, built in the 1800s and home to all manner of local legend. The old schoolhouse, supposedly haunted but simply full of rats. The abandoned American airbase, rich with stories about heroic Yanks, downed bombers and war-torn lovers. Lovers. First loves can be powerful things. They stay with you, follow you through adolescence and young adulthood. Sepia-tinged memories that linger long into old age, if we're lucky. As a lad, I would loiter at the local shopping precinct in Sankey, known as the Square, in the company of folk I often couldn't abide, in the hope I might steal a moment with one of the girls I'd fancy from afar. I never did, of course. My own first loves were unrequited. Ever the coward, the Square would forever stay with me, a theatre of missed opportunities. All of these were on my doorstep. Each of them set my pulse racing as a youth. And it's no surprise I've returned to these memories in my writing as an adult. I don't think for a moment I'm the first writer to hark back to their childhood in their writing. Stephen King, one of my favourite authors, regularly returns to the streets of Maine he haunted as a boy. Gerald Durrell returned time and again to the island of Corfu, directly recollecting the childhood adventures he and his family experienced. Boy by Roald Dahl, which focuses on his life from birth up until leaving school, and how these experiences, sometimes grotesque, directly led to him eventually becoming a writer. These authors and the genres they ordinarily work in vary wildly, but each of them has been drawn back to specific locations from their childhoods. A sleepy town in Maine, an island in Greece, a boarding school in Somerset. Such autobiographical elements in stories rarely fail to add a tone of realism to the text. When the author is writing of what he or she has known or experienced, there's an honesty there that captures the imagination and belief of the reader. While writing the Weirworld series of fantasy novels for Penguin between 2011 and 2013, I felt the nagging need to write a story set not just in the real world, but rather my world. Or should I say, my hometown. Haunt, Dead Scared, is based very loosely upon my life growing up in Great Sankey, the people I encountered, both friends and enemies, and the places that had such a profound impact upon my early years. Undoubtedly, it remains a genre work. It's a fantastic black comedy featuring two teenage best friends, one living, the other dead. But it's rooted in the streets and buildings of my childhood. As manuscripts go, I found it one of the easiest and most enjoyable I've ever written. I knew I wanted to write a ghost story, and I wanted elements of my own life in there too. Setting the tale in Sankey was the easiest way to frame it. I plotted the story out by the major events of those early years and where they took place. I closed my eyes, I was back there with a bang. Perhaps the emotions I felt as a child have heightened in some way in the intervening years, or at least my recollection of them has somehow magnified them. Maybe my age-addled brain has embellished these character-defining moments. While all my pals put in appearances, either as amalgams or fractured versions of themselves, it's the places I've stayed faithful to, the locations that are home to my memories. The square is there in all its grotty glory, as are the girls I fancied from afar but never plucked up the courage to kiss. It wouldn't be a coming-of-age story without a bit of romance, even the failed variety. St. Mary's Road, which I cycled down most nights, chased by zombies of the mind, reappeared in Haunt. Only this time round, it was the opening chapter of the book. Will, our protagonist, is killed in a hit-and-run while cycling home. He's dead before he hits the tarmac. That's directly inspired by one of my friends being hit by a car on that stretch of road while cycling. Or rather, cycling into a parked car because he was fiddling with his Sony Walkman and not paying attention. My pal woke up in Warrington General, the luckiest lad I knew. Will finds himself in the same place, only he's now a ghost, returned to Sankey to haunt his best friend Dougie. It's at the hospital where Will and Dougie meet the Major, the ghost of a US airman shot down during World War II. In addition to providing comic relief, the Major's role is to act as a guide, escorting the newly deceased onto the spirit world. What better place for such a gig than Warrington General? And where better to find all the drama of life and death than in a hospital? The Victorian railway station took on a life of its own within the story. One of those childhood friends of mine used to join me down there as a teenager, the platforms deserted of an evening, the pair of us sharing a cigarette and trading tales. Once a year, the fair would come to town, setting up on the scrap of land outside the station, opening one day early for Danger Night, where no rides were safety tested and they were half price for the evening. Bright lights, spinning waltzes, Wurlitzer organs, they all feature in the book. Out of those recollections, I created a phantom of my own, the lamplighter's ghost, a sinister spectre that haunts the old railway station. With his stovepipe hat and ghastly habits, he's my own take on Spring-Heeled Jack. No such legend existed when I was a child, but it was the station that forged the phantasm, the village that spawned the story. I revisited Sankey in the sequel, Dead Wrong. In particular, the old Burtonwood American Air Base, which was mothballed and demolished in the 1990s. As a boy, my friends and I would sneak onto the base, avoiding patrolling guards, to explore the old runways and tunnels above and below the ground. We'd find spent shell cartridges, decommissioned munitions, exotic ration canisters, and other oddities discarded by GIs decades earlier. We swore blind as kids that we'd come back to the base to film our own war movie when we grew up. That, unsurprisingly, never happened. The chance, I'll reluctantly admit, might have now passed. However, it seemed only fitting that the base should feature heavily in that next book, as Will and Dougie attempt to reconnect the ghost of the Major with a local girl he'd fallen for during the Second World War. By the end of the novel, the Major and his first love are reunited and gone from this world, and Will assumes the mantle of spirit guide at the hospital. Writing these books had an exercising effect on those ghosts from my childhood. Drawing on these places I myself had haunted, the school, the churchyard, the station, the hospital, the airbase, proved a cathartic experience and allowed me to lay to rest a few demons of my own. While my teachers, girlfriends and best mates appeared in the manuscripts, so did the bullies, who finally got their comeuppance. I was back in Warrington General in the summer of 2018, when we lost my dear sweet mum to a sudden and unexpected illness. The meaning of places and locations change over time. My earliest memories of the hospital are relatively cheery, interspersed with the odd badly broken arm. They've been replaced by much sadder connotations recently. I only hope that in the years to come, they can change again, and that old building can provide us with some happier memories and stories to look back on.
That was Curtis Jobling. You can find out more about Curtis on his website at curtisjobling.com. And that concludes episode 294, which was recorded and produced by Yasser Amir. Coming up in episode 295, Stephanie Norgate speaks with Jane Draycott about dramatising a pioneering life and the landscapes of Sussex. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.